At this time, I would like to turn today's program over to Scott Schaefer. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, everyone. Morning to our mountain and Pacific guests. Thank you for joining us. We're happy to have you with us. My name is Scott Schaefer. My partners Shashank Upadhyay and Justin Beyer and I will be presenting today's installment of Saifar Shah's 2013 Trade Secrets webinar series entitled Trade Secrets in the Pharmaceutical Industry. Before we get started, I'd like to, we're having a problem changing the slides. There we go. I'd like to introduce Shashank. He is a partner in our intellectual property group, strong focus on pharmaceutical and medical device practice. Prior to joining Saifar in early 2012, he served as executive vice president of global IP and regulatory for several drug companies. He's the author of the leading treatise on pharmaceutical patent and FDA law. He also serves as an expert witness in cases involving the NDA and ANDA approval processes. Justin and I are partners in Saifar's commercial litigation group. We focus our practices heavily on the trade secrets, computer fraud, and restrictive covenant subgroup. The topics we are going to cover today are these. First and second, what is a trade secret and how it's misappropriated? Third, not listed on the slide here, what are the typical remedies a court awards when it finds trade secrets theft? Next, we will describe some examples of information which pharmaceutical companies often seek to protect as trade secrets, including examples of secrets at issue in civil litigation and criminal prosecutions across the country. Then we'll share some insights on how best to protect and prevent loss of trade secrets in litigation, also in relationships with third parties and in dealings with the government. Finally, we'll share a war story or two based on Shashank's experience with the pharmaceutical companies we mentioned before. And finally, at the end, we'll try to reserve time for some of the questions that you post per the instructions you were just given. Again, we thank you for joining us. We hope you find our presentation useful. And, of course, we're happy to assist you or your clients with any trade secret litigation or auditing needs. So to get started, briefly, what is a trade secret? How does the law define it? As you may know, the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, now in effect in 48 states and the District of Columbia, with some variation in each state, provides that pretty much any business information which is a trade is a secret, and which its owner keeps a secret may be protectable under the Uniform Act. Information is a secret if it's not generally known in the industry and it generates independent economic value for its owner. Information is kept a secret under the Uniform Act if its owner uses affirmative measures, which are reasonable under the circumstances, to safeguard its confidentiality. Now, as far as the secrecy efforts, we should be clear that absolute secrecy is not required by the courts, and courts say that, quote, extravagant protective measures are not required. Nevertheless, we've seen in cases recently that the absence of anything in writing, such as NDAs, confidentiality stamps, password protection in addition, limited restricted distribution within the company, we've seen that plaintiffs have a very hard time succeeding in their trade secrets cases if they have not used any of those types of protective measures. Though no one protective measure or combination of measures is a deal killer in a trade secrets case, the courts are increasingly requiring some effort, NDAs, confidentiality stamps, and the like, in order to let those trade secret cases go to trial. You may have seen before these six restatement factors. These are all now essentially codified in the Uniform Act, but we'll go through them nonetheless. The first two are the extent to which the alleged trade secret is known outside and inside the owner's business. Third, the secrecy measures that the owner has taken to protect the confidentiality. Four, the value added by the trade secret. Some experts in trade secrets cases say this is the incremental cost or cost savings or incremental revenue generated by the trade secret. And fifth and sixth, the extent of the investment of time, effort, and expense for the owner in obtaining or creating the secret, as well as what the time, effort, and expense a competitor would have to incur in obtaining or replicating the same trade secret. Again, these factors have been essentially blended together and codified in the Uniform Act. The smaller the knowledge circle under factors 1 and 2, and the larger the quantity under factors 3 through 6, the greater the chance that the plaintiff will have in succeeding in a trade secrets case. So that's how information constitutes a trade secret. We'll talk now about how it's stolen. What is misappropriation under the Uniform Act and similar common law claims? The acquisition, the Act not only outlaws the acquisition by a perpetrator by improper means, but also the subsequent misuse of that stolen information by anyone who knows or has reason to know that the information was properly taken. So just like most other theft laws, the Act punishes not only the perpetrator, the guy who pulled the trigger, but also those who knowingly create a market for the stolen merchandise. So how are trade secrets stolen? These days we've seen through experience that the favorite methods are thumb drives, external hard drives, emailing files to a personal email address, and in some cases, uploading those files onto FTP sites. Those are the go-to methods. Some misappropriators go a step further and try to wipe their company-issued computers or laptops of any trace of illicit file removal. Those who own trade secrets, employers, for example, should be happy to know that 9 times out of 10, any illicit removal or wiping is readily discovered by a run-of-the-mill forensic analysis, which doesn't cost much to undertake. We note that, well, let's skip down to the bottom bullet. Some courts are split on whether mere acquisition and possession of a trade secret without subsequent use on the market is actionable. Some courts might say, well, if you haven't used it, then there's no harm, no foul. Come back when there's been a sale. Other courts say, including courts here in Illinois, would say, hey, the mere possession of a trade secret, unauthorized possession, constitutes a loss of exclusivity, a loss of value, and thus you have a trade secrets lawsuit. We'll note that the Uniform Act, going back up to the bullet above, the Uniform Act says that reverse engineering and independent development do not constitute misappropriation. I'd like to distinguish between that and the claim by a defendant that a stolen product or process or information could be reverse engineered or independently developed. For example, many defendants might say that might justify a clear-cut case of misappropriation by saying, well, I could have easily done it and reverse engineered it from information available in the marketplace. Often that usually doesn't work. Courts usually don't buy that. So those are trade secrets. That's misappropriation in brief. Now let's talk about what the courts award successful plaintiffs. Money damages. In effect, the greater of a plaintiff's lost profits or a defendant's ill-gotten profits, or if plaintiff cannot prove either of those, the court can impose, in its discretion, a reasonable royalty and the defendant's sales of products or services incorporating the stolen secrets. Further, if there is willful and malicious misappropriation shown by the plaintiff, then the plaintiff can get its attorney's fees, expert's fees, expenses, and exemplary damages. Exemplary is another word for punitive, and the Act says that you can get punitive damage award up to twice the actual damage award. That's money, what equitable relief is available. There's preliminary and permanent injunctions for actual or threatened misappropriation of trade secrets. The Act also provides for an interlocutory temporary royalty imposed on defendant sales in lieu of a preliminary injunction. And the courts have equitable powers to require the return of all stolen information and secrets and anything else that fits within the court's traditional equitable power. At the bottom, we note that the fee shift provision under the Uniform Act, that's a two-way street. If plaintiff brings or even continues a misappropriation claim in bad faith, then courts may award the defendant their fees and expenses and having to defend against that. An example we've seen in California is that a court awarded a defendant over a $1.2 million in its fees where plaintiff failed to prove that it even owned the alleged trade secret. At trial, the plaintiff failed to prove ownership. Also, earlier this year in Pennsylvania, an appellate court said that the plaintiff should have to pay the defendant's fees where the plaintiff continued a misappropriation claim even after the trial court denied plaintiff's preliminary injunction motion on the basis that the alleged information stolen was already in the public domain. So the lesson here is that both plaintiffs and defendants should be aware that they could be liable for fees if they've been litigating in bad faith. Okay, now I'll turn it over to Shashank, who will talk about trade secrets that are specific to the pharmaceutical industry.
Great. Thanks very much, Scott. I appreciate being here, and I appreciate everybody's attention and for all the people who have signed on. In this slide, we're looking at the R&D and development pathway. The purpose of this slide is not to show all the activities that occur during preclinical and phase 1, 2, 3, during the R&D process, rather to show where in those phases trade secret information might come up. So, for example, in the preclinical and discovery stage, you might see vision planning. And by vision planning, that means when the brainstorming occurs, what candidates are you going to go after? What is your plan of attack? Even that in and of itself, that plan could qualify as a trade secret. As you move along further, you might begin screening different candidate compounds to determine why you want to go down a particular path or what chemical moiety might be worth pursuing. Your choice and your selections and why you go down a certain path and why you choose not to pursue a certain path is trade secret information. And again, as you develop further and you start developing a lead candidate, and you might even begin doing some early manufacturing and undertaking some specialized manufacturing techniques to push the project forward. Again, as you push the project forward in phase 1, 2, and 3, as you move from animal models to human models, again, you're going to be refining your lead candidate. You're going to be looking at the various species of candidates that you might want to continue to push forward. And so from a funnel concept, you've started large, and now you're progressively starting to narrow that window. Any type of chemical synthesis requires optimization. So for yield improvement and or impurity improvement, you might be looking at various techniques as to how to do that. Your bench trials, your synthesis techniques using organic or recombinant, if you're in the biopharmaceutical world, why you're picking your choices the way you are, again, you know, may qualify as trade secrets. As the product matures and you start getting into the finished dosage form and the formulation, that in and of itself is highly protectable as a trade secret, including any safety and efficacy information that you may generate during your pharmacology and toxicology studies, because that's the kind of information that subsequently will form part of your QA/QC standards and your ICH compliance, which we'll get to. Your choice of clinical trials and the sites that you use, the physicians or the preliminary investigators that you might choose, and obviously the data that comes back out of the clinical trials is protectable. As you kind of move along the pathway, you move towards the actual dossier itself. In and of itself, your FDA dossier, whether it's the IND and or the NDA, ANDA, or 505B2 application, is chock full of information that provides the recipe on how to make that product should it be stolen. All communications with the FDA are highly protectable as trade secrets also, because it's the kind of information that a applicant wants to know. This is of concern to the FDA. It provides a competitive advantage if you understand what the FDA is looking for and what methodologies or protocols the FDA may want implemented. From the REMS, this is the risk management and the risk evaluation and management systems. So those are also protectable as trade secrets in underlying data. Now, the data itself is protectable. The implementation of that data may or may not be protectable as a trade secret, but any information that's collected through the REMS might be protectable. As I alluded to before, QA, QC, your quality assurance and quality control controls, your CGMP standards, and your ICH compliance all form a web of trade secrets information, because if you think about it this way, these are the kinds of things that you do within your facility. These are the kinds of things that help you get your product through the approval process and ensure that the FDA or any other regulatory agency is not going to pull your product. Obviously, we see commercial launch factors having the normal and more public trade secrets information. So we classically see trade secret theft in the form of sales data, marketing plans, customer lists. But in addition, in the pharmaceutical world, you see feedback, and in the form of either the ADEs or just general marketing feedback, the information related to COGS, especially if you're intending to manufacture a competing product, it might be important. Supply chain and supply chain integrity is also important, because that also helps you determine which supplier is your supplier of choice, and that provides a competitive advantage. And then on a go-forward basis, forecasts are obviously important information. In the post-launch world, as you do life cycle management, if you're on the brand pharmaceutical side or if you're in the generic side, you know, you do also have some information that you collect in the form of new plans and the kinds of things that you're going to do in the future to life cycle manage. So in terms of theft, you can imagine that if a brand pharmaceutical company has an immediate release product already on the market and has plans but not yet have executed against converting that into extended release formulations, it would be the kind of information that's worth stealing so that you could get the jump on that brand pharmaceutical company. Again, feedback, ADEs is also important. These are the adverse drug events. So that data that comes in is important, because that provides competitive intelligence as to new updates or new warnings, and perhaps that will lead into new indications. New indications are important, again, because this helps your brand pharmaceutical company decide, you know, if they're going to go after new indications and perhaps apply for patent protection on that. So if we step back for a moment and keep ourselves in the world of the R&D pipeline, obviously R&D groups produce lots of useful information in the form of data of the candidates that work, the candidates that don't work, data points on in a certain direction. So when we have looked at all of these trade secret cases in the pharmaceutical world, we've been able to compile them basically into three different areas in the R&D world. And we look at those motives in the theft where the theft occurred to directly compete, you know, with the main drug, with the drug candidate there. So that was a head-to-head race to who could develop the drug first. Then there were a category of cases that were related to the theft of the trade secrets to indirectly compete via a separate product. So this is could be another drug candidate in the same class or therapeutic class, or it could be another drug candidate in, say, combination therapy with the original monotherapy drug. And then the third category that we saw in the R&D theft world were things related to misappropriation of trade secrets for the purposes of filing a patent to block out the original company, especially under the new race to file system. So as you can see from the R&D development process, it produces a lot of tangible products, processes, and data that is protectable as a trade secret. But in the pre-approval R&D world, most trade secrets misappropriation is of these data, formulations, or processes. And in the post-approval world, this misappropriation is more on the commercial information, as I point out, such as the sales data, customer lists, and COGS. So with that in mind, I alluded to a couple of cases, and therefore I'd like to go through some of them that we just quickly found. So again, staying within the world of the R&D side or the pre-approval side misappropriations, there's a University of Colorado versus American Cyanamid case that came out of the Federal Circuit in 2003. Essentially, the facts were simplified to be the brand company had collaborated with some of the university doctors to do some R&D. The doctors had sent the data to the brand company, who then filed an application, patent application, without naming the doctors as co-inventors. The brand company ultimately lost their lawsuit, had to name the doctors as co-inventors, and the doctors were awarded around $53.1 million in lost revenues and lost royalties from the arrangement that they had. So again, when you read the case at the trial court level and the Federal Circuit level, there was the compelling evidence here was the lack of written agreement that outlined the roles and responsibilities between the brand drug company and the doctors. So ultimately, again, although this was a patent case on inventorship, the theft of the trade secrets that ultimately resulted in the $53.1 million award was based on the misappropriation of the trade secrets because there wasn't adequate documentation between the two companies, between the two parties. Similarly, in Rhone-Poulenc versus DeKalb, another Federal Circuit case coming out of 2001, what's interesting here is that the alleged misappropriator here, DeKalb, had legal access to the trade secrets in the first place. But the complaint was they unlawfully used those trade secrets in an unlawful way. So again, factually and keeping it simple, DeKalb had a license to some of Rhone-Poulenc's technology to do some early stage R&D work. DeKalb had generated some positive data from that work, but failed to inform Rhone of that positive data. In addition, DeKalb allegedly induced Rhone to divulge more about its technology and provide more information that DeKalb ultimately then used to file a patent application in an effort to box out Rhone-Poulenc. As we go through the trial and through the misappropriation and the thefts, and then we get to the Federal Circuit, ultimately Rhone was awarded $1 million in compensatory damages, $15 million in unjust enrichment, and $50 million in punitive damages, ultimately because of the theft. So here, again, one of the key takeaways is the lack of written documentation between the two parties. Moving on to another case, this is Norbrook versus Hanford, as you see. This came out of the Northern District of New York in 2003. Factually, there was a standard way of making this veterinary drug, and it was to use this two-step process of you use a wet material and then you dry it. Because of this two-step process, it was more expensive to do, a little bit more complicated. Norbrook had developed, in a trade secrets confidential way, a one-step direct dry process. But at the end of the day, the employee was hired by Hanford, who then magically developed a one-step process at the competitor. Now here, the court awarded Norbrook damages, and the employee basically told the new employer how to do it. So I wanted to kind of run through a couple of the factors that the court evaluated. So looking here, on the left hand side of the chart, you see Norbrook's development. So what they were able to show as plaintiffs, who were the victims of the trade secrets theft, they were able to show that using this Dr. Quinn, who was the employee, there was lots of trial and error to show this development of this one-step process. In other words, they tried and they failed a couple of different ways and a couple of different times in order to develop this. They had a dedicated team of people that were specifically talented to try to do this one-step process. They had always kept the one-step process secret via security cameras, restricted access, the need-to-know access, and confidentiality agreements among the team and among the rest of the employees. Now, moving over to the Hanford side, now these are the defendants who were allegedly stole the trade secrets. Hanford had hired away from Norbrook, Dr. Quinn, who then became a brand new employee at Hanford. Now, Hanford had classically done the two-step process using the wet and the dry, and then through the litigation, it was shown that, in fact, in developing their new one-step process, Hanford had zero evidence of any experimental work. And in fact, they had created that one-step process in direct from bench chemistry all the way up to commercial scale with nothing in between and no failures to report. In addition, they had no specialized talent or specialized team that was key towards doing manufacturing improvements. And again, the employee, Dr. Quinn, was the sole member of a team, meaning a team of one, who was in charge of developing a one-step process improvement. And furthermore, the credibility of the employee, Dr. Quinn, was in serious question. So it's not, in this case, it was not hard for the district court to find or the jury to find that, in fact, Hanford had stolen the trade secrets from Norberg in the point of hiring this employee and not doing anything to independently develop. So moving on to Scott's point before that, having proper documentation, so the key takeaway for that case is that you should be documenting all of your experimental data. Even if you get a new employee come in, you should be making sure that they comply with any agreement that they have and that you can show, if you had to, why you were able to reverse engineer.
That's right, Shashank, and thank you. And picking up on a point that Shashank made with his first slide as far as visions for anticipated drugs, visions can be trade secrets. Last year in BYU-Pfizer, the site's there on the screen, the federal court in Utah held that a pre-planning vision may very well constitute a protectable trade secret and denied Pfizer's motion for summary judgment on the university's claim involving its professor Dr. Daniel Simmons' late 1980s vision, quote-unquote, to develop what is now known as Celebrex, the anti-arthritis medication. Dr. Simmons' vision, which evolved over the course of BYU's R&D agreement with Pfizer, encompassed 42 steps, soup to nuts, including animal testing, chicken and mice testing, of developing a COX-1 inhibitor drug. The court said that though most, if not all, of these steps by themselves may not have been secret enough in the industry to warrant trade secret protection, their selection and arrangement in the professor's sequence was the possibly protectable trade secret enough to go to trial. The court cited the Utah Supreme Court's decision 2 years earlier in USA Power, which held in part that, quote, binders full of information, end quote, and the obvious joke there being not binders full of women, had trade secret potential, even though many of the individual contents of those binders were public records. It was the plaintiff's particular selection and arrangement that were the particular know-how that were triable issues of trade secrecy. Just for note, the BYU case settled not long after this summary judgment decision prior to going to trial. Also, another example of a civil trade secrets case involving the R&D process, it's a dated decision, but in Hoffman LaRoche versus Yoder, the court found that HLR's alleged trade secrets regarding its Accutane testing protocols, IDBs, and clinical investigator correspondence were not trade secrets. The defendant in that case was a doctor and a former HLR investigator for Accutane, and he, in January of 96, took out an ad to sell the clinical trial material at a starting bid of $9.5 million. Which in today's dollars is over $14 million. Despite this, what the court called a hefty price tag, thus demonstrating independent economic value. No, we can go back. There you go. Thus demonstrating independent economic value, the court said, well, all of this material has been in the literature for the last 19 years since the clinical trials. Thus, it's not a trade secret. It's generally known in the industry. I think more important to the court's decision in HLR, however, was that HLR did not do anything, next to nothing anyway, to restrict access to its trial material. It had no NDAs with its investigators, no other appreciable affirmative security measures, and at trial, or I'm sorry, in the summary judgment briefing, HLR only pointed to conflicting testimony about its from its in-house people, saying that there were oral, handshake, implied confidentiality agreements. Those unspoken, unwritten, unexpressed security measures just did not cut it, even at the summary judgment stage. Another case involving R&D at the production method level along the R&D process map. Production methods are often not protectable trade secrets because the farm companies often have patented those processes. Patents are generally, by definition, not trade secrets. The patent claims are published. The best-known production methods are published. So you cannot argue that they are not generally known in the industry. So a farm company's decision whether to patent a process or to try to keep a trade secret indefinitely, that's usually a mutually exclusive choice. So in Glaxo v. Nova Farm, coming out of the Eastern District of North Carolina in 96, Glaxo had patented its crystallization process for Zantac, but after patent, by accident, it had discovered and used an alternative crystallization production method, which the patent did not cover. The court said, well, it's not a trade secret because even if this alternative method, which included alleged secret combinations of solvents, pH and heating parameters, and a seeding crystallization method, those were too well known. That's what researchers do all over the industry. Those are not trade secrets. Plus, there was enough evidence in that case that Nova Farm had independently developed its similar process. Its researcher came up with that process on its own, thus refuting Glaxo's misappropriation claim. The Glaxo court also shrugged off Glaxo's claim that its knowledge of what does not work can be a secret. As Shashank pointed out earlier, and which is the case, a pharma company's knowledge of what does not work can be a trade secret. Nevertheless, there was no proof that Nova Farm had benefited from that proof of a negative knowledge. So the next slide. So far we've discussed civil cases. We should also point out that there have been a number of criminal prosecutions for trade secrets theft, most notably under the Federal Economic Espionage Act. The statute cited here was amended recently, and I think Justin will go into this more a little later, to extend its reach to internal trade secrets, which may or may not find their way into the stream of commerce, as well as to stiffen its civil penalties. And this act, I think, has caught more press recently because of all the trouble in China we've been having. The examples of some of the more notorious trade secret convictions and indictments. First, in U.S. v. Wan Li, District of New Jersey, 2011, a Sanofi chemist, a Chinese citizen who resided in New Jersey, pled guilty to stealing Sanofi's trade secret synthetic compounds and trying to sell them on her website to Chinese pharma companies. Similarly, in U.S. v. Guangzhou, which is only at the indictment stage so far, but the two defendants are being held without bail. The government recently won the bail hearing. Two Eli Lilly biologists and researchers were indicted for stealing Eli Lilly's R&D data for the listed products there and offered to sell those trade secrets to a Chinese pharma company in exchange for jobs. An older case, U.S. v. Sue, out of Philadelphia in 1999, federal court, the defendant attempted to buy Bristol-Myers Taxol technology from a corrupt Bristol-Myers employee. There, the sentence was less stiff. The defendant pled guilty to time already served, $10,000 fine, and 2 years of supervised release. So all of these cases teach that not only the remedies for trade secret theft are not just limited to the civil arena. If you can convince the government to go after departing employees when you have solid proof of theft, then the government does a lot of the work for you. I'll also note that in the recent indictment in the Eli Lilly case, the government alleged in its indictment that Eli Lilly took a number of extensive affirmative measures to safeguard its trade secrets, including guard and key card restrictions to its campus, visitor badges, visitor logs, visitor monitoring, employee NDAs, and periodic confidentiality training, limited internal need-to-know distribution, computer access restrictions, data security banners, and restrictions on the publication of any of the research and development data. So it's a powerful piece of evidence that Eli Lilly has, having the U.S. attorney validate its security measures in a public indictment. So on that note, I'll turn it over to Justin to talk more about security measures both before and during litigation.
Thank you, Scott. And before we go on, though, it's time to read the CLE attendance affirmation code. To receive one credit of CLE for this webinar, please write down the following code on the CLE attendance affirmation form, which will be emailed to you at the end of this week. The code is SS0461. Now, as Schenck and Scott both well covered, there are obvious issues with the misappropriation of trade secrets in the pharma industry, but protecting those trade secrets go beyond simply protecting them internally at your company. That they also require pharmaceutical companies to consider their trade secrets and how they treat those secrets in both court and governmental interactions with third parties. The Federal Rules of Civil Procedure cover trade secrets in two main ways. One is through Rule 26, which permits courts to enter protective orders to prevent the disclosure of trade secrets or to protect those trade secrets during the pendency of a litigation. The second way is by allowing companies to move to quash or modify subpoenas that seek the disclosure of trade secrets, and that's through Rule 45. One thing that we're seeing, though, in our practice is that courts are requiring more of a particularized showing of secrecy and confidentiality in considering those protective orders. Whereas in the past, courts would almost pro forma issue protective orders, now they're requiring more from a company to show that these are, in fact, trade secrets, that these are, in fact, subject to reasonable protective measures, and that should be something that companies take into consideration when pursuing litigation. The other thing is that no secret is ever truly safe from disclosure. In fact, Coca-Cola was required to disclose its formula, a formula that only a handful of people knew back in the mid-1980s. The other thing is that companies must take strenuous efforts to protect their trade secrets when they reach trial. As Scott discussed previously in the Glaxo v. Novapharm case, the court determined that Glaxo had in fact waived its trade secret protection based on its in-court disclosure of those trade secrets, both in testimony and through the documents introduced. Giving a little bit of background even further, Novapharm sought to originally challenge Glaxo's Form 2 patent, lost at trial, then submitted a new ANDA or ANDA for the Form 1 generic. When it got to trial on the second case, the court determined that Glaxo had in fact disclosed much of the information that it was claiming trade secret protection over in the first trial, either through the testimony that its witnesses gave or the documents that it disclosed or the documents that introduced as evidence in the original trial. The lesson to be learned here is that when you reach trial, it's not enough to have a protective order in place. You have to go farther. You have to maintain the confidentiality of that information. You need to move to seal exhibits, have in-camera hearings where necessary, where trade secrets are going to be mentioned or divulged, seek to close the courtroom from the public, and take other reasonable steps to protect that information. And maintaining the confidentiality for a pharmaceutical company goes beyond court proceedings, though. The federal government has a number of measures that permit companies to protect their trade secrets. And just by way of example for the pharmaceutical industry specifically, the Food and Drug Administration permits trade secret and confidential commercial or financial information to be exempt from public disclosures. The Freedom of Information Act permits federal agencies to withhold information if the information constitutes trade secrets or confidential information. And finally, subject to certain limitations, companies are permitted to redact trade secret information from patent, trademark, and copyright applications. And just to unpack the FDA's treatment of trade secrets a little farther, the FDA is not permitted to disclose trade secrets or confidential commercial or financial information during the time in which a company has submitted its application for approval of a new drug. The company has absolute discretion as well to determine what it is marked as a trade secret or as confidential information. And if the FDA receives any request for disclosure of those documents, the company has 5 days to object and state the basis for objections. Now, what constitutes a trade secret has changed through the years. Back in the 1990s, the definition of what constituted a trade secret was much broader. It's been modified to be one where there must be a direct relationship between the trade secret and the productive process. But the FDA is still fairly conservative in what it turns over to the public, relying more on the confidential commercial exception. It's also important to note, though, that where an NDA is disapproved by the FDA, withdrawn by the company, or the product is abandoned, the FDA can disclose data upon request. And moving on, we want to focus a little bit of time on what best practices there are for companies to protect their trade secrets. This starts at the beginning of an employee's employment, and it goes through the time that the employee leaves the company. There needs to be internal onboarding checklists and exit interview policies. Companies should make clear at the outset of employment that they're not willing to accept trade secrets from any competitor, that they don't want to rely on those trade secrets. And importantly, there should be penalties that are in place for disclosure of a third party's trade secrets, including and up to terminating that employee. In terms of the exit interview policies, you also want to make sure that the employee is reminded of their confidentiality obligations to the company, to do a media audit as well as collecting any computers that were used, any external media devices that they would have utilized for legitimate business purposes while they were employed, as well as potentially taking their phone at that point and wiping any data that is on the phone if they had an email address on the company phone as well. You should also make sure to have confidentiality agreements in place, but as well as that, there should be yearly training programs that remind employees of the confidentiality obligations, of the company's policies related to confidentiality. Importantly, as Scott mentioned in the recent Eli Lilly criminal litigation, Eli Lilly did utilize yearly training programs, and each of the defendants in that case were subject to that. Moving away from the internal policies, there should also be collaboration agreements in place with third parties. That would have solved a lot of the issues that arose in the University of Colorado case that Shashank had mentioned previously. Other things that companies should take into consideration are work-from-home policies, particularly with researchers, deciding whether that's actually necessary. If you restrict the ability to have – we had a comment from the audience that it sounded like we lost some audio there for a second. But if you have work from home restrictions in place, that would obviate the need for researchers in particular to have the ability to sync their computers with a VPN network or to utilize external media devices on their computers. Another thing to keep in consideration is whether internal notebooks can be used as an alternative from working from home or blocking USB usage. We'll talk a little bit more about USB usage in general in a later screen. But another thing that companies need to keep in mind is how they want to regulate or if they're going to regulate social media usage or internet usage policies. This isn't something that we're seeing as much in the pharma context, but other industries are really struggling with how to monitor and maintain confidentiality and not run afoul of the NLRB's policies on companies restricting social media usage. And another topic we'll talk about a little bit more is cell phone usage. In our experience, and as Scott mentioned, the two main ways in which information is stolen from a company is through downloading documents to an external drive or emailing documents out. And there are a number of forensic tools that are now available to companies to help better protect against misappropriation of electronic information. Probably the most appropriate and easiest to implement is disabling the USB drive usage on computers. As we've all mentioned, USB drive usage is particularly prevalent in this day and age, but it's also the main means by which we see documents leaving a company's control. There's also USB drive usage software that exists and monitors and tracks usage of the USB drive, the documents that are downloaded there. One of the main drawbacks to this, though, is that there needs to be someone responsible for monitoring that software. There's also other data loss prevention tools to track core documents. One of the biggest drawbacks of that, though, is it's very labor intensive, and the company must constantly determine what is a quote-unquote core document. There's also FileSite software that's available that tracks views, copying, changes documents, but you want to avoid the key logging software as it generates a lot of false positives, as anyone who accesses the document would trigger the quote-unquote key logging software. And there are also software that exists that prevents printing of sensitive documents. That also can be utilized through VPN to prevent printing to home printers. Continuing on, one thing that a company can do is, even from the outset, is to perform a trade secret audit. Outside professionals like Seyfarth or other companies can help you determine how easy or difficult it is to steal trade secret information, going through with business people and IT to determine what tools are already there, what policies are in place, and what can be done to better implement additional policies and procedures. And one thing that is important as well is to consider how you manage your employees' smartphone usage. There is a unfortunate ability on the iPhone in particular where a company email address is also on a phone with a personal email address, whereby someone could access their company email, send the email to their personal email, and then change the sender on the email from the company to the personal email address, and thereby move information without a sent item ever being generated in the company email address. There is software, though, that can prohibit this sort of email account to email account mailing. It also then tracks or it blocks email account, or sorry, it also can prevent usage or emailing photos from the work account, as well as that software allows the company to wipe the phone or the company piece of the phone if the phone is stolen or if the company leaves the company without the phone being wiped. Some other data considerations that companies want to keep in mind is, have you defined what a trade secret is for your company? And in a pharmaceutical context, when you're talking about the formulation of a drug, that's obviously an easy question, but you want to start with the question of, what information do I want to keep out of my competitors' hands? And that list can be very broad. Another question that companies should be asking is, what to do about cell cameras? Now, prohibiting cell cameras in the workforce is probably not feasible, but Can they be limited in certain instances? Can they be kept out of labs? Can certain employees have to check their phone when they come into work? And something that companies should be taking into consideration. And finally, from moving away from the standpoint of employees misappropriating trade secrets, companies should also be determining whether or not their external security precautions are sufficient to prevent a hacking situation. We've seen over the last few years where significant trade secret information has been posted on sites like WikiLeaks, but we don't know all the times where trade secrets have been misappropriated off of computers. That might be something that's private at this point. So that's something that companies should take into consideration. Now, moving over to Shashank to share a couple quick war stories, and we'll answer a few questions after that.
Okay, thanks very much, Justin. I mean, you know, we heard a lot here about the protocols and the processes that could be in place to help protect trade secrets. You know, what I'd like to do is just kind of share some of my experiences that I had when I was in-house counsel. So, you know, there was a time in which a new employee, in an effort to show his worth to the new company, our company, you know, wanted to talk about, you know, how to solve certain problems. And then when we asked him, well, how do you know this is going to work, he blatantly came out and said, well, that's the way I did it at my other company or my former employee. And, you know, at that point we stopped and we said, look, we remind you that as part of your onboarding process and your onboarding interview, we expect you to keep the confidentiality of your prior employee. Now, the other thing that that does for a company, though, it tells you as an employer that this is the kind of employee that when he leaves your employment might be willing to share your information just as easily as he was willing to share the information of his prior employee. So at that point, he was a new employee, but we automatically put him on a confidentiality program and made notations to his personnel file. So in the event that we had to bring charges up against him or if we were accused of theft, we could say that we took some remedial action. We had another new employee. He had come to our company complete with the USB stick full of ANDA dossiers and NDA dossiers. In other words, for lack of a better word, he was ready to plug and play. That's the kind of information that's extremely valuable, but that is outright theft. This employee had come 10 days after he had started. We had terminated him, and also we had referred him to the local assistant United States attorney, you know, for a possible prosecution. In another example, we had seen that in various situations, employers had failed to enact firewalls around new employees. So when a new employee does come to you and says, you know, I used to work at a competitor, and then you're supposed to put protocols into place and to give them only certain access and to deny them access to everything else. There are times in which we'd have meetings, and then I would have to ask that one employee to leave while we talked about the project, and then we could bring him back in when he was available. There was another one where we talked about is in a co-development agreement, the firewall was actually quite porous. It wasn't a wall at all, and it allowed there to be intermixing of the data, and our co-development partner actually took that information and filed patents on it or patent applications on it, which got us into the same kind of mess as the University of Colorado case. So at the end of the day, you know, these things happen and they happen all the time, and a company has to be vigilant. As Scott pointed out, it's not enough that the employee discloses, because that's one aspect of trade secret, but if you as a receiver know that you're trafficking in stolen information, you yourself can be liable.
That's right. Thank you, Shashank. We've finished our presentation, but we do have a few questions from the audience that we'd like to answer, time permitting. First one, we won't name the questioner, but the question is, what is the difference between trade secret law in New York and Massachusetts, where the Uniform Act has not been adopted, and all other states? Good question. The substantive law is not really any different. Recall that the Uniform Act essentially codified those six restatement factors, and New York and Massachusetts courts look to those restatement factors. Extent of the knowledge in and outside the company, the secrecy measures taken, the value added by the alleged secret, and the time, effort, and expense needed to create, obtain, or replicate. Those are the factors. I will say that the main difference, main practical difference perhaps, is attorney's fees. In New York and Massachusetts, you likely cannot get attorney's fees if you succeed on a trade secrets claim because there's no statutory authority for it. Earlier this year, I blogged on a New York trade secrets verdict. The plaintiff who made subway brake technology got a $15 million verdict from a European company who was alleged to have stolen it. But that $15 million probably just paid for their attorney's fees. The case had gone to arbitration twice in Sweden, had at least three appeals in the New York state court, and a lengthy and extensive trial, and both sides were represented by major law firms, nationwide law firms. So it was likely that most, if not all, of that $15 million verdict was eaten up by attorney's fees, which, because New York does not have the Uniform Act, plaintiffs were unable to recover. So that's kind of the key practical difference between uniform states and non-uniform states.
The next question is, how would we know if the information available in the public domain is in fact a trade secret? That's a difficult question to answer. Generally, if you have information that's available in the public domain, it by its very nature is not a trade secret. Now, the difficulty is, has that information been wrongfully disclosed? If the information has been wrongfully disclosed, then the company to whom the information actually belongs should be taking affirmative actions to remove that information. For example, let's say that some information ended up on a website of a former employee that is now publishing the secrets of X pharmaceutical company. Now, that may be obvious on its face that that information was wrongfully disclosed, and if you want to rely on that information, you should be careful in doing so. Now, otherwise, let's say, for example, it ends up in an academic publication. Now, by the very nature of the publication, that information, whether it was trade secret or otherwise, is most likely going to have lost that trade secret protection if it ever had trade secret protection in the first place. The next question we have is, what about information which comes unsolicited to the company? A customer feedback with no attempts by the company to reach customer, and the one where company seeks the feedback. That may depend. There are effectively safe harbor provisions in the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, which prohibit a company from utilizing trade secrets that they don't have a right to possess. Now, the difficulty is whether or not the company would know that this qualifies the trade secret. And that may depend on whether the customer has a non-disclosure agreement in place with the company whose information they're sharing. Prime example is pricing. Pricing oftentimes is not a trade secret. It's information that may be flexible, and it may be something that a company is willing to work on with the end user of the product, particularly if you're buying in bulk. But unless there's a non-disclosure agreement in place between the customer, then the customer is free to share that information, either sought by the company or shared independently by the customer. Now, in receiving that information as a best practice, it may make sense to ask, do you have a non-disclosure agreement in place with the other pharmaceutical company? Depending on how they answer that question may depend on how you decide to accept, whether to accept that information or not.
Great. Thanks, Justin. We have another question of, how does a company advise a government entity, such as the FDA, that its information qualifies or constitutes a trade secret? So I would kind of refer you back to the slide. There's a slide that's called Unpacking 21 CFR 20.61 that Justin had gone through. But the short of that long story is that FDA considers the information any time sent to the FDA is actually deemed to be confidential in the NDA or the IND or the, you know, ANDA. But then as a consequence, when there's a FOIA request that comes in, the FDA will revert back to the company and ask them, what do you consider in this dossier to be trade secrets information? Now, one of the important things here is that the FDA considers from the top of the left corner to the bottom right corner of the back page, everything in there to be confidential unless, of course, it's proven that it's in the public domain. So in terms of documentation sent to and from the FDA, that's deemed to be confidential. And then you can look at the provisions in 21 CFR 20.61 that Justin has on the screen now, and you can look at, you know, particulars of that disclosure.
Thanks, everybody. I think we're out of time. I think we have one more question. Do you think we can field it, Shashank? The question is, what information could still be regarded as a trade secret when the company gets a patent published on the drug candidate? Further, if that information is regarded as a trade secret, can then the patent be invalidated for the owner not having disclosed fully the best method of performance of invention?
Okay, so that's a great question. So first and foremost is that if it's published in a patent application or in an issued patent, it's deemed to be in the public. And so the information is dedicated to the public. So as Scott mentioned before, publishing in a patent document is antithetical to keeping it as a trade secret. On the other hand, if there is underlying, you know, processes of manufacture that you don't disclose in the patent application, then that stays as a trade secret. However, you know, the second part of the question is, can you invalidate if you keep this best mode of manufacturing secret and it's not disclosed in the patent application, can you invalidate the patent? And under the new American Invent Act, no, best mode is no longer a basis for invalidity under Section 112. So the moral of that story is that you should be complying with your duties to disclose all the information to enable the invention in the patent application itself. And as a consequence, anything you put in there will be deemed to be a trade secret. I mean, well, deemed to be public. Sorry, not a trade secret.
Okay. Thank you, Shashank. Thank you, Justin. And before we say goodbye, thanks again to all of you for joining us. We hope you found the content and the presentation useful. Feel free to follow some of our Trade Secrets Group blog posts on www.tradesecretslaw.com. And feel free to contact any of us or anyone else in our Trade Secrets Group or Intellectual Property Group with any questions or any needs you might have. So we have a, you know what, one request just came in to repeat the CLE code. I think we can do that. Justin, do you have the code? It is SS0461. Again, SS0461. With that, we'll say a good day. Thanks again for joining us, and good afternoon. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you for participating.